So after 9/11, there was a quote that went circulating quite widely. Maybe many of you have heard it, maybe many times. And a little story that went like this. A Native American grandfather was talking to his grandson about how he felt. He said, "I feel as if I have two wolves fighting in my heart. One wolf is vengeful, angry, is the vengeful, angry, violent one. The other wolf is the loving, compassionate one." The grandson asked him, "Which wolf will win the fight in your heart?" The grandfather answered, "The one I feed." And I think it doesn't take a lot of mindfulness to realize, for most of us, that there are all kinds of different impulses within us. Different motivations, different thoughts, different feelings that we have. And we tend to validate some more than others. We tend to get involved in some more than others, indulge in some more than others. We tend to focus on some more than others. We tend to feed some more than others. And for people, I think often in life, this can go along somewhat unconsciously. We're not so aware of the influences behind what we feed, what we support, what we indulge in, kind of the food, the conditions that support the particular states of mind, motivations that we have. And part of the call of mindfulness practice is to start being aware of the diversity, the range of what goes on within us, feelings, motivations, thoughts, ideas, and then to begin to relate to them in a wiser way, in a wise way. And one option that exists is, like the grandfather here, is to feed particular ones, the useful ones, and let the unuseful ones maybe starve or atrophy away. It's been a lot in my mind these last weeks about the war, and particularly in my role as a Dharma teacher in our center, and what to say about it, how to respond to it. And one of the very interesting things, I think useful things, that people who practice mindfulness can do in this context is to be very carefully aware of how they're influenced. So aware of our body, our feelings, our thoughts, our belief systems, our state of mind, by often the subliminal messages that come around at this time. And so rather than kind of just going along in the currents of what's happening, to really stop and be mindful of the immediacy of what's going on in our body mind as we do things. So something as very simple as I've noticed that some of the news around the war, I don't watch television, so I'm not sure, but I've been told that happens there quite a bit also, but is couched in patriotic music and tones and images and beautiful banners of the American flag across it, and just feels so uplifting to see these beautiful colors and whatever. And then they talk about a family of 11 kids killed in a checkpoint in Iraq. But so you have all these influences that come, and the subliminal influence I could imagine of patriotic flag and the music, kind of even NPR has this kind of music that is I don't know how to characterize it exactly, but some of it's kind of this, when they talk about the war, they have this music in between little segments, and some of it is this marching music, like war music, kind of marching along, and a little bit so how does that influence us? Does it influence us in any kind of way at all? And we know that from television and advertisement and all kinds of things, the tremendous power of subliminal messages, the fact that canned humor has no humor in it at all, but because we hear there's all this laughing going on, it's contagious. Or we hear this music and the drama and it builds up and it sounds like something really terrible. People are walking beautifully down a wonderful forest path, but then you hear this ominous music and you realize, oh, something's about to happen. And the music kind of affects us. So what are the influences that come our way, and how do we relate to those influences? There's influences of our friends, of people we talk to and colleagues, and they take different positions. And then based on their positions around the war, you know, then we are maybe influenced a little bit by either by their position or perhaps influenced in the degree of what you feel safe to say, how do you say it. Sometimes it can be contagious, a group mind, everybody rallying around some particular cause. And the anti-war movement in San Francisco, when they had the demonstrations, friends of mine who were there were quite distressed that the degree to which the some of the protests were so virulent. You know, a lot of anger and aggression being expressed. One person I know who went up to San Francisco planning to be arrested as soon as the war broke out the first day. And she wasn't able to, she went to work really early that day so she could leave work early to go. But she wasn't able to leave work early enough to really get up there first thing in the morning. And so she got there at midday, I think, 12 o'clock. And by that time, she didn't want to be arrested because the atmosphere was so angry. So, you know, even people, you know, in the anti-war movement, the peace movement, could, you know, the group mind, something, get enough people together, it sometimes it's contagious and we don't really know how we're being influenced. And then, you know, it's the way in which we're influenced by discomfort. You know, we see painful images, we hear painful stories, and it hits us in the gut, it hits us in the heart in some way. And then we might not be so cognizant of how that motivates us, how that changes our thinking and what we do based on that. We might get angry. We just kind of look up, anger seems justified, and we let the anger pour out, or we run away, or we close down in some way. So the very interesting thing to do with for someone who has a mindfulness practice is to be attentive there at the influences that come our way and how we take them in, what we do with them. And I think this is a really great time to do it because the influences are so strong and the consequences, I think, are quite significant. I think it's very significant for people, very helpful for individuals to be aware of these influences and be careful with what they say and what they do and what they want, you know, how they act. So which wolf do you feed? And then the questions also are, what are the values that you live by? Because the values that you live by have a lot to do with the wolves that you feed. And then that is useful to reflect on. What do you really believe? And I found myself a little bit disturbing. Some of these polls that are reported. And the polls, just the idea of a poll about war and killing, it just, you know, seems, I don't know, it just seems so sterile, I don't know, just kind of technical. But, you know, that if 500 Americans are killed in the war, you know, half of Americans are okay. I forget exactly the numbers. But if it's more than 500, then the majority of Americans are against the war. So, you know, the our values, you know, as a country, or you know, at least by the poll, as the pollsters find out, seem to be related to such issues of as how much loss there is. I suppose there have been similar polls on how many Iraqis are okay to kill or get killed in the war. And it's above a certain threshold, it's not justified, causing, you know, the exchange. But what are the values that we live by? Because the values we live by affect, you know, what we're going to feed, what we're going to support. And the values we live by also have a lot to do with what we feel is possible and what we feel the consequences are of both of our beliefs and our actions. And if we feel that there are no consequences, if we feel like we're helpless or hopeless, you know, then certain values of falling through of them don't have any point, then we're not going to feed that particular wolf, feed that kind of way. But if we feel it does have value, then we're more likely to do it. I think a lot more people would go and join anti-war marches if they felt this was really going to stop the war. It makes a difference. Or people who are for the war maybe have comparable kind of thing. If they really felt that their voice really mattered, they would do something. So how do we maintain hope, or how do we maintain a sense of the consequences of our values as we hold to. And one of the things that I find a lot of value in or belief in is that there are benefits from holding to our values that are independent of the external consequences, that our own welfare, our own sense of well-being for ourselves is dependent on the values that we live by also. And so even if you're the only one on your block who has a particular value, and you feel that, that's where your integrity resides, to live by that value preserves your integrity. But you know, to give into it, give it up for the sake of the group or other values, then you know, it feels wrong inside. The Greek philosopher Plato had an idea, as I probably don't have it quite right, where he said something like, if all things are equal between two people, same kind of background, same, you know, everything's equal between two people, except one of the people is unjust and the other one is just, the person who is just will have greater happiness. So they have all the same kind of conditions around them, same success, or, you know, all, you know. But the person who's just will have greater happiness than the person who's unjust. And why is that? Why is it that the suggestion, I think, of Plato is that the just person will be in harmony with her or himself. The unjust person will be fragmented, and will all these different forces pulling them left and right, and their desires will take the up, you know, various kinds of desires will take over, and they have no control over their own what they do. The unjust person is acting on certain kind of unwholesome impulses, whereas a just person is trained themselves, perhaps, or you know, is in harmony with themselves, and that harmony produces a greater sense of happiness for the person who's just. The Buddhist paraphrasing of this would be: the trained person, if all things are equal between two people, the person who's trained their mind or their heart will have greater happiness than the person who's untrained. And I think simply the reason is that an untrained mind will, you know, can have a heyday. It's like, you know, if your mind is completely untrained, you're not paying attention, it can be like, you know, the parents have left and the teenagers are home. I don't know if that's necessarily a good example, but for some people it is. And our desires get pull us around by the nose, or our aversions or hates or whatever. And a trained mind is a mind that that is not going to be led around by impulses, not going to be led around by the first motivation that pops up, but has some ability to be present and mindful and independent of all kinds of forces of the mind. In the teachings of the Buddha, this kind of discussion of which wolf to feed fits under the category of right effort in the Eightfold Path. And the formulation of it was one that for many years I ignored and actually didn't like so much, and I thought it was kind of moralistic and it required kind of a lot of, you know, exhausting effort. And coming out of the Zen tradition, there, you know, the it was much more of a non-dualistic practice. And the sense I had was, you know, this was kind of dualistic, this way of thinking. But in recent years, I've come to appreciate this a lot, this particular formulation. And it sounds a little bit dry, but it says, the definition of right effort is the effort to avoid or prevent the arising of unhelpful states of mind that have not yet arisen. It is the effort to abandon unhelpful states of mind that have arisen. It is the effort to prompt or cultivate helpful states of mind that have not yet arisen. And it is the effort to maintain or protect those helpful states of mind which have arisen. Those four things. And one of the turning points for me in looking at these four efforts, where it became much more real and personal for me, was I stopped looking at it as this external teachings in Buddhism, this another list that I had to somehow weigh myself down with. One more list of things to do in Buddhism, my God. And it's enough just to pay attention to my breath. That's hard enough. But rather I turned it around and said, okay, I'll assume that I'm already doing this. This is something I'm already doing. And then I said, okay, let me notice how I'm doing that. And then I found out that I'm doing it all the time. And I kind of was, I don't know if unconscious is the right word, but it seems like it was just built into the structure of my mind or the activity of my mind to some degree, and probably most of you, that you're doing it all the time to some degree. So you might think about, you know, are there small ways in which you already do this? Many years ago, I mean, very small comes to mind. Many years ago, I noticed that when I lived in San Francisco and would commute down to Stanford, I noticed that the state of my mind would be better if I drove 280 than 101. And I decided that I liked that better state of mind. So I would take 280, even though if all things were equal, it was a little bit longer to go 280. And that seems like a pretty sensible thing to do. I've noticed in my life that my mind's appetite for food is different than my stomach's appetite. And this quality of my mind, the quality of my heart, the word mind, heart are the same in Buddhism, is vastly improved when I listen to my stomach rather than my mind. So to notice this impulse for desire in my mind, I've learned, just kind of pretty, it took a long time, but I learned to just leave that alone. And I've learned through my practice a lot, for me, that desires are a dime a dozen. You know, they're really cheap, they're really easy to have. And I've learned most of the time now that certainly much more than it was before, I've learned not to pick them up. Just we talk in Buddhism about things being self-liberated. So I let the desires be self-liberated, which means I don't pick them up. You know, don't do anything with them, and then they poof. You know, sooner or later. Sometimes not soon enough. But and then I've noticed that when I was at Tassajara, the Zen monastery training there, they had a practice there of, it was kind of a goal-less practice. Just be fully present for how things are, radical presence for how things are. And liberation was found in that radical presence. And kind of a radical acceptance of things in the present moment as they are. Not seeing things for or against things, not seeing things as being good or bad, and particularly, but just being fully present in that full presence, trusting that you'll live an ethical life and a wise life. And for a while I was assigned to the garden. And I loved being in the garden. And this kind of maternal, I call it then maternal, but paternal instincts came out. And you know, I'd go around every morning and check on the little plants and see how they're doing. And it would take me a long time to start working because I just go around and check on all the plants. I noticed, you know, that in the garden, that it seemed like a good thing to pull the weeds out. And it seemed like a normal thing to do, pull the weeds out. And there were all kinds of theories about how to weed in wise ways, but, you know, there you pull the weeds out to help the plants grow, the ones you want. And it didn't. No one told me it was dualistic to do that. No one told me that it was somehow, you know, wrong to be picking out the weeds so that the tomatoes could grow. And I started thinking about my own mind, and I thought, are there things in my own mind that I would like to weed out so that I could be a better and more helpful person in the world? And isn't that as commonsensical thing to do as brushing my teeth? We brush our teeth because that's a useful thing to do. Shouldn't we brush our minds? Some people choose their clothes better, spend more time choosing what kind of clothes to wear than they spend choosing what words to use or what kind of mind states to support or what to feed. So what I came to was that in Zen practice, the non-dualistic Zen practice, didn't exclude the possibility of weeding out the anger from my mind. But it included that. Was weeding out the anger in the mind was within the context of this big mind that we were being taught there. So is it appropriate, not to act on anger? Is it appropriate to notice the anger that arises and to not, to abandon it when it arises or not pick it up? Is it appropriate to look ahead, think ahead, about what might arise in certain circumstances, what might arise in our hearts, and then to do what it takes to prevent that? Some people avoid reading newspapers these days because of that reason. They don't find it useful or helpful to have the states of mind, states of heart that arise when they read the paper. Some people don't read the paper because they're aversive or to the pain that they feel within themselves when they read the paper. And you can avoid the paper for healthy and helpful and unhelpful reasons. Simply because it's painful to read the paper is not a reason to avoid the paper. But if unhelpful states of mind arise, if you read the paper and spend the rest of the day being angry, maybe you need to be careful about reading the paper. The suggestion of the Buddha is not necessarily avoiding things, but rather to be very attentive at the place where stimulus from the external world hits you in the moment, comes to you. It's called safeguarding the sense doors, is the technical word. It's protecting the quality of your mind by being attentive to what is coming your way and how you pick it up. And that requires being in the present moment to notice that. And so to notice what comes through the eyes, what comes through the ears, the nose, the thoughts, cognitively. To safeguard the quality of your mind so that you don't pick it up in a way that brings up an unhelpful state of mind. I think the advantage of people who meditate or do something like meditation, but other things do this also, not just meditation, is certain activities we do improves the quality of our hearts. It makes our heart more loving, more peaceful, kinder. It makes it more non-conflicted. And then how do we protect that? Is it valuable to guard that and to protect it? And so the teaching of the right efforts is if you have a sense of what's your own good quality of heart, then do what you can and that's helpful to protect that. As I think Tanjeff might have said last week, or certainly people like him say at times in Buddhism, is that the most precious resource that you have as an individual is the quality of your heart, the good qualities of your heart. And the most valuable thing you can protect are those things. So to make the effort to avoid the arising of unhelpful states of mind, which has not yet arisen, to make the effort to abandon those unhelpful states of mind which have arisen, and to make the effort is not easy, once they've arisen. But it's really noble to be interested in making that effort, whatever it takes. And there's all kinds of different strategies that people have of how to deal with that. Some people just find going for a walk or sitting in meditation. There's many different kinds of meditation to be done. But some way of not feeding or not adding to or to helping us let go of or not be in the grip of these states that arise. One classic practice in Buddhism is to practice the antidotes to these states. when we're in grip of very strong desire, then perhaps we can. One of the antidotes for desire is said to be impermanence. Another antidote for desire, depending on the kind of desire, is to think of the unappealing aspects of what you're desiring. In terms of lust, the unappetizing aspects of what you're lusting for. I'm sure there's unappetizing things in your fantasy that you can conjure up. And so when you're really in the grip of lust, and it's really powerful, and you seem like you're sweating because of it or something, then Buddhism suggests that you think about the unappetizing body parts of the person. Aversion, when you're in the grips of aversion or hate or anger, one of the beautiful antidotes is loving kindness practice. To somehow fill the heart with love and kindness. Remind yourself or touch into that part of the heart, to that corner of the heart, to that wolf in the heart that's capable of love and kindness. It's a beautiful thing to do. And then there's making the effort to prompt the arising of helpful states of mind which have not yet arisen. And there's many ways of doing that, of prompting that. One of the beautiful ways is to sit and meditate. I find that, not always, but meditation gives access. One of the beautiful things about meditation, or things like meditation, is they can prompt the arising of beautiful states of mind without there being a reason for them to be there. Like, you don't have to be, you can have joy without having a reason to be joyful. So many of us are looking for reasons to be joyful. And we run around and looking for things to make us happy. But in things like meditation, or maybe, you know, if you leave yourself alone enough, the mind is freed enough, then joy will just bubble up by itself. Happiness will come. A state of peace will tend to come. It's quite beautiful. It's quite a trick, though, to leave the mind alone enough like that and to have that arise. But it's possible. And then there's the effort to protect those beautiful states of mind, the helpful states of mind that have already arisen. So which wolf are you going to feed? What do you do with the influence that come your way? What do you know your own wolves? So when I did this reflection on how is it that I'm already doing the four right efforts, one of the things that I realized for myself is that the four right efforts were a description for me of leaving my heart alone, were a description of getting out of my way. And so, rather than striving and pushing for some kind of goal in practice, I found over and over again that one of the most useful things I could do is to get out of my own way, to get out of the way of the natural arising of helpful states of mind, the natural arising of freedom. And the four right efforts were descriptions, in a sense, for me, of getting out of the way. It's most obvious with the first two, with the unhelpful states of mind. And I think because of this, I have a very optimistic, I don't know what to say, appreciation of the human nature. I think human nature is quite beautiful because the heart that is left alone, the heart that is not in conflict with itself, I think is radiant. It's beautiful. And when evil arises in the world, it's from a heart which is not left alone, radically alone. So So those are my thoughts for this morning. And may all your wolves be happy. Do you have any comments or questions? You find in Asian Buddhism of all kinds, much more the language of spiritual warrior. And they talk about the torments of the mind, those things which torment the mind or cause suffering within us as the enemies, and you know, kind of cut them down or kill them, and things like that. And here in the West, most people don't appreciate that kind of language. Maybe it's a different mindset here for a lot of the kind of Western conditioning, that kind of feeds into kind of self-loathing, sense of self, lack of self-worth, or to a kind of moralistic approach to understanding our life and, you know, sin, you know, original sin, and I'm bad, and things like that. And so the tendency here in the West is to present the Dharma independent of this kind of spiritual warrior language of, you know, taking the sword of wisdom and slashing off the head of your anger, or things like that. And certainly that's the case in the Spirit Rock scene. I've noticed that's particularly true for male teachers. They don't get close to this idea of talking about, you know, being a spiritual warrior and killing your defilements. Though some of the women do. Some of the women talk about being spiritual warriors and much more going to fight those things. And I think it has a lot to do with our cultural, not only our conditioning, but also our... I don't know what to say exactly, but I'd be very reluctant to talk about being a spiritual. I know for me, I'd be very reluctant to talk about just, you know, killing and stuff, because I'd be seen, oh, that's just a male way of talking, you know, and it'd be discounted, you know. But if a woman says it, it's okay. So, you know, we have our own thing here in the West that we have to deal with. And in Asia, they don't seem to have that problem, and it seems to be very inspiring for them, that kind of approach. And I suspect that they don't have this automatic negative thought about who they are. I'm, you know, they don't think of themselves, I'm an angry person, therefore if I'm attacking myself, there's anger within me. I'm a great guy. There's anger within me, and that anger is my enemy, and I'm going to kill it. So it lends itself sometimes to kind of a little bit more ferocity in the spiritual practice. Let's get down to business here. Is that okay? You didn't actually ask a question. You just kind of I just went on and on. Yes?
Could you expand a little bit on how you get out of your own way? Some practical
example. One way that I love is concentration practice, like mindfulness of the breath. You know, I'm in my way, I'm kind of lost in my thoughts and my judgments and my all kinds of, you know, desires and aversions or whatever. And then, you know, my mind is preoccupied in some way. And when I start putting the energy of the mind, the energy of attention, into my breath, I'm pulling it away from those preoccupations. So I'm beginning, awareness, attention is kind of like a food. I think it's useful to think of it as a food. And what are you feeding? And if your attention is lost in preoccupation, you're actually feeding those preoccupations. And if you're feeding your something wholesome, like staying on the breath, then you're feeding that, and you're beginning to get out of that, not feed those things that get in your own way. That's one way to do it. One way is simply to note. One very powerful way also is to notice. This works for some people. Is to stop all you're doing. And if you want to do this very radically, you'd even stop all your. You still sit down to meditate. You still meditate, but once you sit down and close your eyes, your dedication and practice is you're not going to do anything at all. You're not going to follow the breath. You're not going to. As soon as a little idea comes up, I'm going to do this kind of spiritual practice. No. That's even a doing. And then you notice that you begin going down some kind of thought train. I'm not going to follow that thought. Or You know, whatever the mind does, it's kind of like a doing. You let go of any of the doings. And you need to be somewhat concentrated or, in order to be able to do that. Yes?
I've found for the last year or so that without doubt, the hardest thing, place that I come up against limitations in my practice is mindfulness about the current political situation. It's fairly easy to accept or to see what is happening, that first part of mindfulness, but the acceptance of it, I find very, very difficult.
I don't know if you're supposed to be accepting of it. What acceptance? So the word acceptance is very problematic. It's a very, very, very much used by our scene, our Buddhist scene, and I use it a lot. But it lends itself; it has a range of meanings, and so it lends itself to an idea that of being almost condoning the situation. The situation is okay. I'm going to accept it as it is. The acceptance of practice is not an acceptance of that things are good or bad, or it has nothing to do with kind of a healthy discriminating mind about what's going on out there. Acceptance means that your heart is not going to close down because of it. It means that your awareness is going to stay open and not contracted because of this. So you're accepting it into your awareness without being for or against it, as opposed to accepting the situation that the situation is okay. So the situation, you might feel some situation is terribly wrong and unjust. And you're not supposed to not have that discrimination. But even if seeing something as being unjust, the acceptance means that you're not going to do, you know, tighten down or contract within you because of it. Does that make sense? So because of that, lately, rather than using the word acceptance, I'm preferring the word nonviolent. So rather than to accept what's happening, we want to have a nonviolent relationship to what's happening. And that comes to the same thing because it has, a better range of meanings. But nonviolent means you're not going to succumb to anger or aversion to what's happening. You're not going to contract around it. Because even anger in your own heart is a kind of violence. And so how can you remain nonviolent in the face of this? But even then, it's difficult. And I think if... When our reactions are extremely strong to some problem in the world, some suffering in the world, some injustice in the world, I think that if we don't in some way act in the world that's in response to it, I think we'll get sick. I think we'll feel off or wrong. So if it's just a matter of accepting it, okay, let me sit here peacefully and just accept it, I think actually it's kind of inhuman. If it's, you know, if a child is screaming in front of you, you're sitting there meditating, the child's there, you know, and some terrible cut and wound and hungry and just a horrible situation, I'm going to sit here and meditate and accept it. I think you would get sick inside if you did that. You have to kind of get up and do something with the child and help the child out. Forget about your meditation. Forget about your acceptance practice. Just like take care of this child. And so that's an extreme kind of example, but for some people who have very powerful responses to suffering in the world, I think unless they feel that they're responding actively, something, you know, the acceptance doesn't quite work. And maybe it's easier to find the kind of acceptance that you were talking about if you also feel that you're responding. Now, responding can take many different forms. And it doesn't have to mean that, the war in Iraq, that you go and directly try to stop the war in Iraq. But it might mean some particular suffering. But it means that maybe some great suffering in the world inspires you to be of service locally. And so, you know, in your community, in your neighborhood, or in your family. Or inspires you in your practice to put more fuel and fire into your practice so you can resolve the forces of greed, hate, and delusion in your own heart. So, I mean, that's a way of acting. It's powerful. It doesn't have to be, you know, directly... You know, there's so much suffering in the world, no one person, you know... can respond to all of it. So we have to make some discrimination of where our effort is best spent. And sometimes it's locally. Does that make sense? Is that okay? Is that an answer? Or do you want to follow up?
To start?
Dick?
used to try to accept, in quotes, situations that I don't like. It's to recognize that they exist, just acknowledge that they exist. Kind of exactly like I accept the rain when it's raining. Okay, it's raining. That doesn't mean it's good or bad. Maybe it's about to flood, and it's not a good idea. So I don't accept it in the sense that I think it's fine if it's raining. But the war in Iraq is something that I think is terrible, as far as being good or bad. But it exists, and then I have to just say, well, okay, it exists. That's okay. It's not going to change things if I don't accept that it exists. It's there.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of wisdom to what Dick is saying. And then, but part of that, in addition, part of that would be that what hopefully also exists is some, the birth of some motivation in our own hearts in relationship to that. Oh, compassion also exists. Yes.
Could you say something about the idea of one country going into another country to liberate it so that it can be free? You know, and just this idea of freedom and how we stand for freedom and having trouble with that. From talking to my son, who's actually pro-war, uh-huh. And I just sort of didn't know what to do with that. Thank you.
It's a big topic. And I feel the strength of how that hits you, your feelings, and I think that I don't know if this is not really a response, but what comes to mind after what you said is the Buddha said a Buddha can only show you the way; you have to walk the path. No one else can liberate you. The only person who can liberate you is yourself. You have to do the work yourself. So maybe that was true for countries too. But, you know, it's not really possible to liberate another country because everybody has to liberate themselves. And that's what they say about Iraq, right? People have a lot of doubts whether Iraq has the kind of has the conditions in place to have democracy in the way that's recognized in the West. And so to come there and impose our ideas of democracy in a country which is doesn't have the conditions for it, are we really going to liberate it then, you know? So I like the idea of wolves too, because the wolves are kind of energetic, and you know, the wolves, you know, are there's energy there and ferocity there, all kinds of things, and you know, it's kind of playfulness and strength. And so may you feed the helpful wolves, and may you retire the unhelpful ones. Thank you all.